Good Tuesday evening. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for June 16th, 2020. Ahead tonight, the idea behind a Juneteenth observation this week in Bentonville is to have a community get to know itself better. We'll have a preview later tonight. Tomorrow on Morning Edition on KUAF, young broadcasters take on society's most important issues in NPR's Student Podcast Challenge, including racial justice and climate change. This year's winners share their work on tomorrow's Morning Edition from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. Also tomorrow morning, the Community Spotlight with Pete Hartman at 6:30 and 8:30, and our state and regional newscast with Antoinette Grajeda at 5:30 and 7:30. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 274 new cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas during the most recent 24-hour monitoring period. That raises the cumulative case number to 13,191. There were six new deaths from the virus, meaning there have now been 188 confirmed coronavirus deaths in the state. The numbers were announced at today's press briefing in Hot Springs, featuring the governor and state officials. Governor Hutchinson says the state has tested all residents and staff at 150 long-term facilities in Arkansas, with another 250 such facilities needed to be completed. Dr. Jennifer Dillahay, the Arkansas Department of Health's medical director for immunizations, says about 38% of the cases in Arkansas of COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic have been in people age 25 to 44.
And these are the adults that are going around the in the community, taking care of their business, and they are the ones that potentially go to work and could bring the virus home if they do not take the necessary precautions in that age group.
Adults from 45 to 64 make up the second highest percentage of positive cases, about 29%. Dr. Dillahay says while people 65 and over only account for about 11.5% of the cases, that age group has had roughly 70% of deaths from the virus.
So what we see here is we may have older adults who have a lower percentage of the cases, but they're at higher risk for dying from COVID-19. Many of these cases that have died from COVID-19 in Arkansas have been in long-term care facilities. And that's why it's very important for us to protect those who live in nursing homes, assisted living, and other types of facilities.
Dr. Dillahay says those numbers reinforce the importance of the necessity for people in age groups with the highest percentage of cases to follow guidelines like social distancing to slow the spread of the virus to people with the highest chances of the most serious complications from COVID-19.
Sometimes people don't know they have it when they spread it. So it's important for people to maintain the social distancing, to wear the cloth face coverings, and to wash their hands frequently. And if we're going to open up our nursing homes so that people can have that loving contact with their loved one who's in the nursing home, then it's going to be really important for us all to do our jobs in the community to reduce the spread of COVID-19 so it cannot enter the long-term care facilities.
Governor Hutchinson says there were more than 4,100 tests administered in the state during the most recent measuring period, keeping the state on track to complete 120,000 tests by the end of the month. He says since he implemented a state of emergency on March 11th, there have been more than 208,000 tests, a number that would represent about 6% of the state's population if each test was given to a different person.
We want to continue to improve that every month, but that shows how we've significantly expanded our testing.
Mike Preston, Arkansas's Secretary of Commerce, says the unemployment numbers appear to be at least leveling as the state moves into its 14th week of the pandemic.
We see the continued claims continue to drop down week over week over the last consecutively now for 4 weeks, dropping from a high of about 122,000 down to about 106,000 as of this last week of reporting. Additional about 32,000 receiving the pandemic unemployment assistance to date. So those numbers around the state, well, certainly are still much higher than we've ever seen as a state. Collectively, we see them moving in the right direction.
Preston says at the end of the month, which is the end of a fiscal quarter, the search for work requirement for unemployment benefits, a requirement that had been suspended during much of the outbreak, will be reinstated. He says the Department of Workforce Services is scheduled to send out notices regarding that shift. He says online applications and Zoom job interviews will count as job search activity. During today's question period, the governor was asked about in-person school classes in light of an increase in cases in the state in the past 2 months. The governor says the state cannot afford to have a limited commitment to education.
And so we want our students to have the full experience of education in a healthy environment. We're trying to figure out the healthy environment. And that's why our Ready to Learn initiative, led by the Secretary of Education, relies upon the different school districts. Listen to parents and what are the concerns and how can we address this and what works in that community. And it'll be a blended environment of in-class instruction with supplemented by online instruction as needed. And so there's many challenges, but we want to have the testing capability. We want to be able to make sure our facilities are clean and that we have alternative ways of instruction, but you have to have that commitment. You have to have that plan to go back to school and adjust as needed.
And again, the subject of getting more people to follow guidelines like wearing masks or face coverings was brought up. The governor has devoted at least some time to urging Arkansans to wear masks and practice social distancing at almost every briefing for more than 3 months. He says he thinks there may be nationally, as he put it, a political taint to wearing a mask, but he says he thinks that's not so much the case in Arkansas.
You know, at first people thought, well, this is to protect me, so I don't need to wear a mask. I'm tough, or I'm not in the age group. Well, now I think everybody understands wearing a mask is a courtesy to everybody around you. And so that puts it in a totally different context. And so there's been some challenges there, but it's also about leadership, and that's where I appreciate, you know, those restaurants that set the perfect example and give confidence and the barbers and salons that know how important this is to their customer base and the safety of everyone. They're going such an extra length to make sure they follow all those rules. And we as a public, let's support those that do the right thing. And if somebody's an outlier, they're not giving a high regard to the public health, let's send the right message, don't shop there. Let's go someplace that they really are setting the right examples.
Finally, the governor says it's encouraging to see the number of new cases lower today than in the past few days, but he warns the number could bounce back up again. The entire briefing can be seen at the governor's YouTube page. The Veterans Healthcare System of the Ozarks is teaming up with the Arkansas Department of Health for a drive-through COVID test for Arkansas veterans, their families, and caregivers Saturday, June 27th at the VA campus on College Avenue in Fayetteville. The test will be administered from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. that day in the parking garage. There is no fee. This is Ozarks at Large. In the wake of the coronavirus outbreak, many farmers have been left reeling. But one sector, community-supported agriculture, which delivers boxes of fresh local produce directly to customers, is flourishing. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports.
In March, when businesses, schools, and restaurants shut down to slow the spread of COVID-19, the demand for some agricultural products plummeted. By May, an estimated $5 billion of fresh fruits and vegetables had been wasted nationally, according to the Produce Marketing Association. But for some smaller farms, the pandemic has had an opposite effect.
We've had a record number of customers for the CSA this spring, summer season. It might not sound like a record, so we've sold 30 this season, and that's what we wanted to sell. And previously, we've never sold that many. We've never hit our goal before. And really, in March and April is when we really hit our stride.
That's Dan Miller, a farmer with Hazel Valley Farms just outside of Fayetteville. His farm operates mainly through a model called Community Supported Agriculture, or CSA, where consumers buy a share of the farm and receive a box of fresh produce each week at their door or at a pickup site. Ann Miller says he believes the new surge in customers was in response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
There's supply chain issues with larger grocers. There's availability issues when you go to the grocery store. People want the security of having a fresh local food supply more than ever. We just opened up our CSA for our August to October. We just opened up last week, and so it's been open for 1 week, and we have sold 23 shares. So we only have 7 shares left. In 1 week, that's pretty unheard of.
But now, with social distancing guidelines and uncertainty about the supply chain, customers are finding CSAs a more popular option. Diana Endicott, executive director for the Food Conservancy in Springdale, says the crisis forced farmers and consumers to rethink food supply and accessibility.
And so we had a lot of farmers, small farmers that were actually had planted and were growing for the restaurants. And then the restaurants closed down. We had some of them that, you know, were supplying products to the schools, and the schools were closed. And even, you know, the hospitals had limited access. So they had a lot of product and not a market for it. So we pivoted and we started the local box program and the local CSA program. And then as far as the consumers, I think the consumers like the idea of the accessibility and the affordability of it.
The Food Conservancy, which aggregates and distributes produce from local farms, started their own CSA provision boxes in response to the pandemic to give farmers another market for their surplus goods and to reduce food waste. And she says while farmers are seeing a jump in CSA shares now, incorporating local food more widely to wholesale markets will make a bigger impact on regional food systems going forward.
You know, even if you do direct to consumer, that's still... In order to grow farms, you have to have wholesale markets. So I think that's the gap that we're filling is, I think the direct-to-consumer provides awareness, and it has a certain demographic of people that want to support that. But we also have a larger demographic that shops at the grocery stores and, you know, and also want to support it. So I think that being able to reach larger wholesale markets, I think that's one of the gaps.
And in an effort to fill that gap, the Food Conservancy sends some of those local provision boxes directly to Harps grocery stores in northwest Arkansas. Still, the coronavirus outbreak exposed the vulnerabilities of the global agribusiness supply chain, and CSAs offer a popular alternative. But as Amanda Perez with the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture says, the model doesn't work for all farms.
We thought that at first there would be this huge kind of shift to local markets. And in some regards, some farms were able to successfully see that happen if they were using some technology platforms. So if they were offering online ordering or marketing through social media platforms, and farms that actually were able to put those practices in place early on actually saw a benefit from that and had at least met all their original sales goals. And some may have seen an increase in sales early on if they could shift to online platforms, because at first, many of our farmers markets were not open or were not planning to open. Some of them opened with decreased capacity. And when they did that, you know, a lot of people were nervous about coming into a public setting. And so they actually, at first, we know that they had a decrease of participation. So for farms who have a community-supported agricultural program, if they were only using a farmer's market that wasn't open, then they would have seen decreased sales because they wouldn't have an outlet for that. If they were able to transition to another site for pickup or to offer an on-farm pickup or delivery, then they were able to meet their sales goals.
Perez says the shift to CSAs is facilitated, like so much during this time, by the internet, which means added effort and stresses for farmers and buyers in rural communities where internet access is limited.
And so people might not be able to get it, you know, at their home on a computer, but they might be able to take their smartphone and drive to an area and connect. But, you know, sometimes that can be difficult to, if you're an individual wanting to make a purchase or something like that, that's a lot of work to do that. So I do think that it would be challenging to kind of get the word out about shifting markets in those communities.
However, she says the renewed interest in local produce right now is an overall benefit.
you know, all systems are usually more successful if they're diversified, because you have less risk and less vulnerability when something happens.
And Dan Miller agrees. He says that if there's one positive outcome from the crisis, it's a shift to more sustainable food systems.
More people are finding out about local farms. This has put a spotlight on local farming as well. So people are searching out and finding local food, either through the farmers market or through CSAs. And I know more CSAs are starting, and that's really exciting. So I think it's increased community awareness about how to support local farms, and in turn, obviously, you know, get nutritious and sustainable food for their families.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Yesterday's United States Supreme Court decision that the 1964 Civil Rights Act protects gay, lesbian, and transgender employees from discrimination based on sex means new protections for many people in states where no specific, on-paper, legal protection for LGBTQ employees existed. The 6-3 decision comes almost 5 years after voters in Fayetteville passed a civil rights ordinance that included protection for LGBTQ residents and workers. Since that passage, with backing from the city council and mayor, the ordinance has been superseded by a state law that does not allow a city in Arkansas to extend protections not already provided by state law. The Arkansas Supreme Court last year ruled the state law made the city ordinance in Fayetteville null. That was a unanimous ruling from the Arkansas Supreme Court. Following yesterday's decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, we asked Fayetteville City Attorney Kit Williams about this most recent development in the ongoing saga.
The United States Supreme Court ruled yesterday in support of equality and against discrimination inflicted upon our gay, lesbian, and transgender citizens. This is exactly what Fayetteville's own Uniform Civil Rights Protection Ordinance did after our citizens voted to support and enact that ordinance almost 5 years ago. The decision by the United States Supreme Court shows that Mayor Jordan, our city council, and our Fayetteville citizens had it right when they sought to protect our gay, lesbian, and transgender citizens from discrimination. The Arkansas legislature brought shame to our state when it passed its Right to Discriminate Act, deviously titled the Interstate Commerce Improvement Act. Arkansas Attorney General sued Fayetteville and fought for over 3 years to nullify our citizens' effort to support equality. The wisdom of Circuit Judge Doug Martin's ruling upholding our Uniform Civil Rights Protection Ordinance has also been vindicated by the United States Supreme Court decision yesterday. But sadly, the Arkansas Supreme Court reversed Judge Martin and ruled that the legislators' Right to Discriminate Act voided our citizen-passed Uniform Civil Rights Protection Ordinance. It is too late to attempt an appeal to the federal courts now, but this United States Supreme Court landmark ruling proves that the Fayetteville City Council and our Fayetteville citizens were absolutely correct to support equality for all of our citizens.
Kit Williams is Fayetteville City Attorney and made his comments after yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that the 1964 Civil Rights Act protects gay, lesbian, and transgender employees from discrimination based on sex. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Penguin Edge BBQ, historic B&B location in Fayetteville. Now open Wednesday through Sunday with takeout, curbside service, and limited outdoor dining. PenguinEds.com for menus and information.
Thanks so much for listening to 91.3 and KUAF on this June Tuesday. We're raising money this month to end our financial year strong. The goal is to raise $35,000 by the end of the month, which is the end of our fiscal year, and we get there with your help. And when we reach that $35,000 goal in June, we can unlock an additional $19,000 being offered thanks to many generous KUAF donors. Your support of KUAF right now does make a real impact. When we reach $35,000 raised in June, we can add that additional $19,000 to the total. You can support the vital news, the music, the conversations you rely on every day on this radio station by giving right now if you're able at supportkuaf.com. And thank you.
Life as we know it has turned upside down, and NPR and KUAF have risen to meet the demands of our time. This unmatched, nimble public service is only possible through your support. During the month of June, we hope to raise $35,000 to offset losses experienced during our spring fundraiser and in underwriting from local businesses. We're asking you to rise to the occasion with us now. We know you turn to KUAF to stay connected to the news and to each other. We also know not everyone can afford to donate, but whatever you can give helps us guarantee access to essential local news. You can keep vital, trustworthy information flowing to you and your community by making a donation today at supportkuaf.com. Your action now determines what is possible in the months ahead, because unprecedented times demand unprecedented support.
This is Ozarks at Large. Friday is Juneteenth, the observation of the end of slavery in the United States. In Bentonville, the day will be marked with a community cookout at Lawrence Plaza. Aaron Clark is one of the organizers, and he says he wants the afternoon to be one of discussion and education among residents, law enforcement, and families.
So basically, my goal for today, for this Friday, is to educate. You know, we're going to have some speakers. There's going to be a cookout. There should be free food for everybody. I got a food truck that's going to be involved, Marty's Soul Food. Just a lot of people in the community are coming together for this event because it's something that is needed desperately in the community, and I want to teach them about the importance of Juneteenth. You know, it was the last day that slaves were freed in Texas, which it marked the day that slavery was actually abolished in America. So it's almost like the black person's 4th of July, but it stands for our freedom. So I feel like it's going to be a great situation to actually coach people and educate people on the importance of that day. And especially when we have with the police and the community there, you know, it's not something that happens a lot in Bentonville.
I think it's interesting. There are people who are very familiar with Juneteenth and its history and its significance. As you mentioned, other people who are not. That's kind of sort of, I don't know, indicative of some of the, what, gaps that exist, the things that some of us don't know that some of us do. And
yep.
Yeah.
No, keep going. I'm listening.
Okay. And I mean, it's just like, it's sort of a metaphor, right? You mentioned this being a bridge. And so, and I'm going to use this in the classic way, an ignorance some people have about something. And I like the idea that you're saying, let's talk about it. Let me explain what it means to us.
Mm-hmm. And see, everything always comes back around to bridging the gap. How do we expect the gap to be bridged if, like you said, they're ignorant to the situation and they don't know? Like, how do we expect them to understand our struggles, our stories, our pains, if they don't know them? You know, if you go to school and you read a history book, it's everything but the real history of the country. In order to not be ignorant of situations, you have to really take it upon yourself to look it up, take time to research, you know? And then we also have to do our part, and we have to educate. We have to be able, like, look, this is what's really going on. I don't know, you learned this in school, but this is the truth. You know, so basically it just all comes back to bridging the gap. I want the officers to feel as close to the community as they possibly can. And I want the community to feel as close to the officers as they possibly can.
When you explain Juneteenth, and like you're talking about nearly 100 years after the Declaration of Independence is signed, that's when some Americans, people born on the soil, first received freedom. When you have those kind of conversations, is the hope that maybe a light goes on for some folks who, for whatever reason, just haven't thought of it that way, about history that way, because they didn't have relatives or ancestors that experienced it that same way?
Yes, I think so, man. Sometimes I think it all comes down to, like, certain people's backgrounds, the way that they was raised, and it really comes down to parenting. Like, me being a parent, I make sure my sons know all about the history. I make sure that they know that, hey, you might go through this because of the color of your skin. Like, I don't shield them from things. Like, I tell them the truth. I'm like, this is what happened. This is what's going on in this country, and this is what your father is fighting to change, you know? So, and it's just like, you know, let me think how to put this. It's just like, when I'm talking to them and when we're going to have speakers come down and stuff and we're talking to them, I want to be able to look them in the eyes and explain, hey, look, This is why we feel like this. This is why some people are rioting. This is why some people are looting. Because I watched this video today, and it was like there was a contract made. We were given our freedom, you know what I'm saying? It was a contract made, you know? A lot of the black-owned businesses, Black Wall Street and different things were burned to the ground. Like, these people are doing this stuff because they feel like there was a breach in the contract. Say, for instance, let me think of a good metaphor. All right, so here I got one.
Okay.
We're at work. We're on the job, right? We're on the job. Two employees get into it. One employee hits the other employee in the face. What happens in that situation? The boss, the manager, the authority has to step in and do his job. Hey, you're fired. But what's going on in the country is exactly the opposite. Black men are getting killed by police officers at an alarming rate, but the authority refuses to step in and make the change. So we feel like it's a breach of contract. When you first apply at a job and you get the job, they're like, these are the rules. Sexual harassment, if somebody harasses you, we're going to come in here, we're going to take care of it. If racism happens, you tell us, we're going to take care of it. But when police do these things, no authority steps in because they are the authority. So who's the authority of the authority who's going to come in and protect us?
What ages are your children?
My children are 9, 8, 7, and 3.
All right, so you've had to already have these discussions that, God, there's not a word.
Well,
that...
my kids experienced a lot of racism in elementary school. Like, and it's really sad. In elementary school, kids were calling them the NIDDRs. You know what I'm saying? They were calling them with the hard ERs. They were talking about them for the skin, calling them blacky or darky or different things like that. And my sons came home. They're like, this is happening. Like, I contacted the schools. The kids got in trouble. But still, it's still cold. It's a cold, sad reality. Like, how are kids in elementary school talking like this?
How frustrating is that for you as a father? I mean,
it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating because I went through the same things growing up, and it makes me question to myself. Why, you know what I'm saying? Why, if I went through this as a child, why are we still in the same place? Why has there not been no progress? Like slavery's been over for over 150 years. Martin Luther King already marched for these things. Why are we still going through this stuff? Like, I'm so confused. Like, and it makes me scared for my kids. Like, are they gonna be going through this in 20 or 30 years? Like, when will there be the time that everybody's equal and everybody gets treated equally? Like, when will that time come? That's what I'm fighting so hard for, is to bridge that gap, because until we bridge that gap, it's just going to be tit for tat, tit for tat, tit for tat, tit for tat. You know what I'm saying? Until we throw ourselves into a whole revolution. You know, we got to nip it in the butt now. We got to demand change now, but we got to do it in a fashion where our voices are truly being heard.
Do you think in some small way, what can happen Friday at Juneteenth when you're inviting conversation, in some small way that can lead to something better?
Yes, I do. And I especially think it will bring something better into the Benton County community. Just all of it. Just Bentonville, all of it. Like, I do, because, like, I don't think that the community really knows their officers that well, you know? And this is a chance for them to come out and get to know them. You know, just being familiar with somebody can de-escalate a situation. Just being familiar. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if an officer pulls me over and he comes up to the car and I look around and hey, it's Dan. Hey, I seen you at the Juneteenth cookout, bro. Them burgers you made were great, bro. And we had a talk, and you know what I'm saying? It was great conversation. Both you and Dan are already going to be familiar with each other. So what's that automatically going to make Dan do? He's automatically going to be more relaxed. His hand's not going to be sitting on his gun. You know, he's not going to be, oh, get, put your hands on the wheel. No, he knows this person. Hey, we was hanging together. We was kicking it together. Your kids was out there. My kids was out there. They were playing with each other. I'm not going to drag you out the car and beat you up or take you to jail. Hey, you seem like a good guy. You know, so that's what this is about, is bridging the gap. And it needs to happen in all communities, all towns, all this. Everywhere needs to be doing this, because it's the only way that we truly are going to
are going to get over this, you know, and try to get over this hump. So it's just like I have a vision, like the Bridge the Gap vision is just like familiarity. Like I want to get a web page up where people can go look at its officers. Hey, this is the officer. This is they from. This they born. You know, this type of thing. Like this should all be public information. The community has to know its officers. Because when you don't and you just running around policing a bunch of people you don't know, the people aren't going to respond to you that well. And especially when you always power tripping.
Are you an optimistic person for the future?
I am optimistic for the future because I feel like that's how we got to be. I feel like it's a mindset thing. If we're not optimistic for the future and we don't think that there can be a good future, if we don't believe it, then it's not going to happen. We can't manifest it into a reality. Mm-hmm. We have to believe it, and then we have to speak it into existence. We have to go out there. We have to make the change. We have to take the necessary steps. We have to take the necessary precautions. We have to go against the grain. Like, you can't, in order to be a leader, you're going to get backlash from everywhere. I've got backlash, you know what I'm saying, just for throwing the event on Juneteenth. And people don't think we should be, as black people, we should be celebrating it with police. But, you know, I feel like, I look at the bigger picture, and I feel like, let's educate them. If they don't know, we can't be mad. If we're not willing to bridge the gap ourselves, then the gap will never be bridged.
Aaron Clark is an organizer of a Juneteenth observation taking place in Bentonville Friday at Lawrence Plaza. More information can be found by searching Facebook. This is Ozarks at Large. The board of directors of Canopy NWA yesterday announced Joanna Krause, director of integration services, is being hired to replace founding executive director Emily Crane Lynn, who announced her departure last February. Founded in 2016 out of a grassroots community initiative, Canopy has resettled 172 refugees from 12 countries. The Lutheran Immigration Service Sanction Agency provides resettlement services to newly arriving refugees, as well as long-term integration support for refugees and other immigrant populations. Crane Lynn says the board conducted a national search, but in the end, chose a candidate from inside the nonprofit organization.
Ultimately, it just came down to the fact that there was no one else who could come close to her level of proven dedication to Canopy and its clients. You know, Joanna has been heavily involved since Canopy was just a very young organization. And even before we had a staff position to offer her, she was willing to put in all the time that it took as a volunteer to just be able to make a difference. She started off in a part-time role and eventually transitioned to full-time. But whether she's been a volunteer or a part-time worker or a full-time worker, Joanna has always gone above and beyond in doing anything in her power to help our clients and further our mission. And so even though, you know, there were other candidates who had a lot of great qualifications and, you know, some exciting experience, there was no one who could match Joanna's proven dedication and knowledge of the organization.
Crane Lynn is moving to Washington, D.C. to pursue graduate studies, where her husband is taking a clerkship with the D.C. District Court of Appeals. She'll remain in her current role through the end of July to assist Krause with the transition. Krause, the granddaughter and daughter of refugees and immigrants, has served inside refugee camps on the Burma border, later taking a job with the International Rescue Committee in Atlanta. She holds a master's in public health from Boston University. She brought that skill set to Canopy when she first volunteered in 2016.
It has been such an honor and a privilege to work for Canopy, and I am thrilled and delighted to move into this new role. I hope to follow in the footsteps of Emily Crane when she has been such a phenomenal leader contributing to the development of Canopy in this community, and I look forward to what's next.
In a news release, Canopy's chairman of the board, Clint Schneckloth, says Krause is the right person at the right time to take Canopy NWA to the next stage. As restrictions on visits to municipal, state, and national parks are lifted, it could be a good time for people and families to take a hike. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, iNaturalist, downloaded on your smartphone, makes it an educational adventure. The app is able to identify what's growing, blossoming, slithering, and singing along the way.
June on the Ozarks is a perfect time to take a hike in the woods. A rain-drenched spring this season has given way to lush urban and rural landscapes. On a recent morning, botanist Jennifer Ogle, collections manager at the University of Arkansas Herbarium, hikes along a trail near Lake Fayetteville, holding her smartphone.
We're standing here on the Clear Creek Trail, right next to Clear Creek near Lake Fayetteville, and we're going to learn how to use the iNaturalist app today.
iNaturalist, developed by the California Academy of Sciences and National Geographic, allows users to explore and connect with nature. iNaturalist automatically generates suggestions based on photos taken in the field. Ogle stops along a steep north-facing slope in front of a large native shrub with dark green foliage and lacy white blooms.
Wild hydrangea in full flower. It's absolutely beautiful right now.
She aims her phone at the flowering shrub and takes a photo.
And I use Android. You can use iNaturalist with iPhones or Android. If you have a smartphone, you can use it. So I've just opened my camera app and I'm gonna take a picture of this shrub, which I already told you what it was, but we're gonna let iNaturalist try to figure it out. It's a little windy, so it might not be in focus, but you want the picture to be in clear, clear focus. And then you want to get close to the flowers. So I've taken a picture of the habit. Next, I'm gonna take a picture of the flowers. The overall shape of the flowers and the inflorescence, or the cluster of flowers. And I'm gonna turn the plant over and I'm gonna take a picture of the back of the leaf too, making sure it's in focus. Okay, so I have several pictures now of this plant, several different aspects, several different parts of the plant. So I'm gonna click share. This is how I use the app. I click share through my app and I click iNaturalist. And it goes to an observation page, and the first thing it asks is, what did you see? So you click on that box, and the cool thing about iNaturalist is it uses image recognition software to try to ID the plant for you. I happen to know what this plant is, so I'm gonna click the top suggestion. iNaturalist was right, it's hydrangea arborescens, wild hydrangea. Unreal, it knows what it is. So I'm gonna click check mark for okay. I'm gonna make sure the date is correct and the time is correct. Very important to get those things right. And then I'm gonna click on location. Every single time I do this, I click on the location and I make sure the location is accurate. Sometimes your phone throws the location off by 100 feet. It'll put you in a subdivision instead of in the woods. So I'm gonna go ahead and check that, and that's good.
Ogle says iNaturalist allows photographers to join certain projects.
If you join a project, your observation will be pulled into that project. And so I've joined the Biodiversity of Arkansas project, so I'm gonna check that. And that way other people who are interested in the flora of the state will focus on those plants or animals. Another important thing, is it captive or cultivated? If it is, you need to check that box. This is not captive or cultivated. It's growing wild on this hillside. Nobody planted it. It's here on its own. And so I've got all the details done now. So I'm gonna click the green check mark and I'm done. It's now posted to iNaturalist. What will happen next is other users on iNaturalist are going to find my observation and they're gonna tell me if I was right or not. I have a feeling I was right. Hydrangea arborescens is a very easy plant to identify. And so someone will agree with me. And at that point, the observation becomes research grade. And so then we can trust that it was accurate.
Next, Ogle takes a picture of a small emerald green worm feasting on jewelweed.
Well, they know the family, so that's good. They're not real sure about what the species is, so I'm just gonna stop at family. It's the common sawflies. And what will happen is some expert in that group is going to come along and tell me if I was right or wrong.
The jewelweed is growing around an ancient limestone spring house where locals once collected fresh water to drink.
This hillside is just full of springs, so it must be that there's some kind of porous rock that the water flows through. And right here, where the water comes out, it's hit non-porous rock, impermeable rock. So now it flows horizontally until it finds an opening.
Like many urban trails, this one is smothered with invasives. Vinca, ivy, tree of heaven, crowding out native Ozark plants and trees. Ogle takes a photo of a strange-looking dragonfly-like insect near the spring and uploads it to iNaturalist.
I think that's a damselfly of some sort. That is a good shot. It sat still just long enough. Oh, it's a little out of focus. But the app was able to ID it anyway.
The spring drains into Clear Creek. We walk onto the shore.
And we just walked upon some Ruellia strepens, which is smooth wild petunia, I think. It has beautiful purple flowers with dark purple stripes in the throat.
Various birds sing and chirp along the path.
You can take a recording of it and upload it to iNaturalist, and it will try to ID the bird for you. Because how hard are birds to photograph? You often don't see them.
We leave the trail and hike to the shore of Lake Fayetteville to see if we can find some snakes and turtles to capture. A river cruiser basks on a snag across the lake, but it's too far away to photograph. Somehow we get onto the subject of Ogle's adopted English bulldog named Junebug.
So I just took a picture of her real quick. I was in my house, so I took a picture. And I posted it to iNaturalist, and all the suggestions that came up were for bats. So she has a flat face and super big ears. We call her a bat pig. That's what we call her. And iNaturalist thinks she's a bat too, so it's confirmed. Of course, you don't want to post observations of your dog on iNaturalist. That's frowned upon. But if you're practicing, it's a good way to go about doing it.
So what is the cost to download iNaturalist?
It's completely free throughout the entire site. And if you use only the app, you'll access certain features. But if you go to the desktop website, iNaturalist.org, and log in, you'll have access to many, many more features, all of which are free.
You can find a link to iNaturalist on our news site, as well as a fun slideshow of our expedition with Jennifer Ogle, including a photo of Junebug, the bat dog. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone from her home in Fayetteville is Lee Wood, who is the general manager of 91.3 KUAF. A pleasant Tuesday to you, Lee.
Thank you, you too.
Okay. It's a Tuesday in June, and June is the end of the fiscal year for 91.3 KUAF. Never a small matter, but this year, there's just a little bit extra importance on the end of the fiscal year for us.
There is. We've, of course, beginning at the beginning of March, like the rest of the entire world, we've seen things change, and we did modify our goal at the spring fundraiser. We exceeded it, which is amazing, but we did not make what we would have made if it was a quote unquote normal fundraiser. And like every other organization or business in this area, we've seen a reduction in our revenue because cancellation of events. And just the regular season of lots of our arts organizations. And so we've seen a reduction in the amount of money that has come in, because of the pandemic. So we've had an end of financial year fundraiser for the past several years in June, but this year we're really trying to, narrow that gap in the revenue that we've seen a loss in because of the pandemic.
And so the goal to get to the end of the fiscal year is $35,000. I know that yesterday afternoon I had a brief conversation with Sherry Ottaviano, our membership director, and we had surpassed $15,000 at least. There's a challenge that we have, and that's nothing new if you've paid attention to our fundraisers in the past, but there's something different about this one this time. What is that?
Absolutely. So we've been in contact with some of our donors who want to give a challenge pledge, which means they basically say, look, I'm going to give you this amount of money, but I want to sort of put it out there as an incentive or an encouragement for other donors to give. And once they give their money, then I'm going to give my donation to you. And instead of doing that as the fundraiser is going on and matching contributions dollar for dollar, we've pooled everything into one large challenge pledge. That's $19,000. And we're going to say that we need to meet the entire goal of $35,000 first. And then when we do, we can add the 19 in. So we're actually going to bring in $54,000 this month instead of just the 35. But we can't access that challenge money until we hit our goal of $35,000.
And according to Sherry's calculations, I think at a point when we were 43% of the way through the month, we were at 44% of our goal of 35,000. That's about as on track as you can be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we are time-wise and money-wise, they're syncing up very nicely. So yeah, we're halfway, a little bit more than halfway through the month, and really close to halfway through to our goal. And as we know from so many fundraisers, that we always see more money and more contributions come in toward the end of the fundraiser. People like to wait till the last minute, and they like to sort of get in right before the deadline. So we expect to see more as the month goes on. But we're really hoping that, you know, people want to give to support so much of what they're hearing on the radio, but also help us get to that goal so that we can unlock that challenge and put that additional money on top.
All right. Support KUAF.com. If you're able, you can do so in the amount of your choosing. When we hit $35,000, it actually becomes $54,000 because of the challenge.
Absolutely. And, you know, since March 13th or so, whenever we really started to go on lockdown, the coverage that KUAF and the Ozarks at Large team that they've provided to our listening audience has been phenomenal. Not just national stories from NPR, but we're really letting people in our community know how this global pandemic, how the civil unrest that's happening across our country, how the fallout of this on the impact on our community, both nationally and locally in the economy. So much information is getting told through KUAF. I know that so many listeners are depending on it every single day. Our costs have not gone down. In fact, they might have even increased. And so it is important that if you're listening and you're relying on the information you're getting from your radio station every single day, that now is the time to hear from you to give a contribution to KUAF.
SupportKUAF.com is where you can do that. Lee Wood is our general manager at 91.3 KUAF. She talked to us from her home in Fayetteville. Lee, take care, and we'll talk to you again before the end of the month. How's that?
That sounds great. Thank you, Kyle.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Hiawassee. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large, a production of 91.3 KUAF. Contributors tonight included Daniel Carruth, who also provided sound from Fayetteville City Attorney Kit Williams, and Jacqueline Froelich, who also provided sound and information about the new director at Canopy NWA. Timothy Dennis mastered our show tonight. Thanks so much to Lee Wood, 91.3 KUAF General Manager, for her assistance tonight as well. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Brand new show tomorrow at noon from the Carver Center for Public Radio. I'm Kyle Kellums. Have a great night.